Welcome to the Urgent Care Leadership Podcast. I'm Lou Ellen Horwitz. As CEO of the Urgent Care Association, and after working in the industry for over 15 years, I've met a lot of urgent care leaders in every role and at every level. These are the people taking the risk of being a little ahead of everyone else. And though we all spend a lot of time talking about the business of urgent care or urgent care medicine, we don't talk a lot about urgent care leadership. So as you've probably guessed, that's what this podcast is all about. I'm really glad you're here, so let's get into it. One of the challenges of urgent care management is understanding the implications of having varied scopes of practice in the clinical team, particularly if you are non-clinical yourself. This bonus episode of the Urgent Care Leadership Podcast digs into those implications. If you've been in urgent care any length of time, you know that the standard staffing model is anything but standard. Most urgent care staff with medical assistants, but medical assistants can do different things in different states, and sometimes depending on their training and experience or how they're certified. Some centers staff with radiologic technologists for x-rays, but train them to do other patient care if the state allows. Some centers train non-clinical front desk staff to do occupational medicine, and some centers use medically trained personnel at the front desk. There can even be confusion among staff about what providers can do, physicians versus physician assistants versus nurse practitioners, and sometimes just varied by a primary specialty in training or provider preference. We're talking about this in a leadership podcast because there's a lot of opportunity for misunderstanding, which has an impact on day-to-day operations as well as overall culture. Joining me today to talk this through are three managers from FastMed Urgent Care: Melissa Nottingham, Area Director for Operations and X-ray Tech; Barbara Carey, Medical Assistant and Clinic Team Lead; and Allison Kaplan, Certified Physician Assistant and Area Medical Manager. Thanks for hanging out with me today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
See you as well. Thanks for having us.
You know, in urgent care, we ask a lot of our staff. We often need them practicing at the top of their abilities and scope, and often their training and experience doesn't prepare them for working in our unique environment. So let's talk about how scope mix plays out in everyday life in the centers that you guys manage and how you handle that as clinic leaders.
I'll go ahead and jump in on that one. FastMed, since I started and probably before that, has always prided itself in being both a teaching and a learning clinic. So we do get a lot of people from all walks of life. We do traditionally have a higher turnover rate due, I'm sure, to long hours and unpredictability in patient flow. But most people find that it's a little bit like sushi. You get into urgent care and you either love it or you hate it. But you really don't know until you give it a try whether it's going to be for you. And I think that that's a challenge that, at least as a hiring manager, and also as a previous trainer, we saw a lot, is people seem like they're very gung-ho to get into it and then maybe realize that it's not what they were hoping for. Or we get people who aren't really prepared for what it's going to be and they find out that they just love it and those people stay with us forever. And that's really cool.
So you're going into this expecting new hires not to be truly ready for urgent care.
We have a lot of in-house training. So we come in kind of being able to adjust our training to what people need as far as what their background looks like. Our front office training program, our trainers have been around for a really long time and they're really good at sort of adjusting how interactive they are with people based on new hire needs.
How much time are we talking about here? How long is the typical introductory training period?
The introductory period is anywhere from 2 to 3 weeks. And then the training period really continues for, I would say, anywhere up to 3 to 6 months afterwards, while people really get acclimated to the differences in the structure from what they're used to, and obviously the ebb and flow of patients.
So does that mean that, you know, given the turnover that we typically have in urgent care because of all the things that you mentioned already, at any given time, you know, there's a handful of people probably per clinic that are in some part of that continuum of onboarding, if you want to call it, just in, as part of the nature of the beast. Allison, from the provider perspective, you know, have you seen, you know, that there are some challenges with that?
Definitely. Yeah. Melissa mentioned a couple of reasons, you know, and as well with you, Llewellyn, the different backgrounds we see, you know, MAs in particular coming from family practice. You know, we do not have nursing staff in our setting. So MAs come from a variety of different fields. So, you know, I think it comes down to that education and training that we provide and following up on that. And we do rely on our providers to, you know, give us feedback. I always communicate with them, you know, hey, if you have an MA that you're working with and they need some extra help or training in a certain area, reach out to either myself, you know, your clinic manager, and we're happy to evaluate that and provide those resources. I always say that, you know, makes or breaks your day, you know, working with the team and who you're working with. So, you know, we always want to make sure that we're available and offering that training and resources that they need.
Yeah, because I can imagine it'd be kind of intimidating to do something for the first time on your own in front of the provider without knowing that they had your back, and that that was, you know, built in part of the culture ahead of time. Is we are a learning and training organization just by choice and by default of the industry. That's important. That's a key piece.
Exactly. Exactly.
Barbara, from your perspective, I'm guessing that you know, on the ground, once they get out of whatever the formal training program is, you're managing a lot of that and really the day-to-day workflow of who's getting what to do in the clinic. Talk a little bit about that and how this sort of interim period plays out.
So I'm actually very involved with the entire process from hire, interview, training. I schedule them. And if they need more training, we put a good team together to make sure that they get the proper training they need. But I did notice, you know, if we hire somebody from, let's say, a surgical facility and all they did was the main vitals, like your blood pressure and pulse and temperature, they wouldn't know how to do the EKG since leaving school. So that's something we would have to train here. And it doesn't take a lot of extra time. I feel like we have very good staff here and trainers in Clay, so it helps along the process. But until they're comfortable and with the knowledge that they're given, it's kind of, you know, a touch and go on who all we need to put in a team. Like the lady said, both of the ladies have said, you know, the team makes it, you know, easy or better depending on who you're working with. It really helps out if you have a good team behind you. But it definitely helps if they come on board, no, in urgent care settings, but that's not always the case. So being able to mold and help people along the way is definitely key.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, FastMed is a big organization, has been around for a while. So you have all of these things in place, but at least half of urgent care isn't like that. They don't have formal training programs. So we're likely doubling up on staff to train people on the job, which leads to extended periods where there's variety in scope until the new person is ready to go solo. What do you recommend as far as balancing the need for comprehensive training against the daily operations needs of the clinic schedule?
I can speak to that kind of from a provider perspective as well, as kind of finding that sweet spot of training, you know, how much, too little, too much. You know, obviously that affects budget, like you mentioned, but I think FastMed over the years has done a great job of recognizing where that spot lies. And it varies, you know, person to person, certainly, but especially for providers, you know, we'd rather give them an extra one or two training shifts than not enough, just for retention, comfort, you know, confidence. And then also, as we mentioned before, in the urgent care setting is exposure, right? You have different patients coming in each day with different needs. So if you're on your training shifts for 2 weeks and you don't see a laceration, you know, you might not have that exposure to document it or work through certain workflows. So we try and give a little extra cushion and time just to make sure they do get as much exposure as possible.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the sort of the cultural aspects of that time period when you've got a variety of people that you can, you know, give a task to, and you're not necessarily sure, is this person signed off on this yet? You know, particularly from the provider standpoint, how do you all manage that in a daily workflow during somebody's sort of training cruise? Is it all funneling through one person who then turns around and delegates, either does it themselves if they're the only one who can do it, or hands it off to the new person because they are signed off on it? How does that work?
So we have a couple main, I guess I'd call them lead back office trainers, and then underneath them kind of designated trainers within the clinics. So like as a provider, you will know if somebody is in training because they're usually in addition to obviously the team member on shift that day. But we will not set anyone free until they've been signed off and cleared on our back office training checklist, specifically for like our MAs.
The whole checklist.
Correct. So they've got to know how to do their EKG, place a splint, do an ear lavage, you know, a lot of those procedural type workflows that are all signed off and required before they are set free on the solo shift.
Okay. So you don't have an awkward middle there where they're signed off on some things, but not other things. Unless circumstances just end up, that's the only
Exactly. I mean, yeah, that should be rare, you know, ideally not happening because they should be signed off on everything. You know, like I mentioned before, there may be times where somebody still needs a little more improvement in that area. And that's where communication is most important, you know, whether it's that team member themselves reaching out for a little more help or training, or the provider relaying, hey, you know, this MA might need a little extra training on EKGs. And then we can send kind of our team out to help with that.
When we decided to start doing podcasts, our first priority was to make them relevant and good. And our second priority was to make them short. Sometimes 10 minutes is all the time you have for something like this in our world. So we'll continue this conversation in our next episode, part two of Scope and Culture. You've been listening to UCA's Urgent Care Leadership Podcast. I'm Llewellyn Horwitz. Let's keep raising the bar on each other, and I'll see you next time.